No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shatterpot Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope that my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And today we have a special guest. We have Officer Pemberton from the police union here in the District of Columbia. Officer Pemberton joined the Metropolitan Police Department in 2005 and worked in patrol and vice in the 3rd District. In 2008, he was promoted to detective and moved to the 7th District, where he worked in the violent crimes unit covering Southeast 6th and Washington, D.C. And that's what we want to talk to him about. Welcome to the show, Officer Pemberton. Thanks so much for being with us.
Senator Brown, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Crime is up in the District of Columbia. It's I understand that many crimes are down, but serious crimes like murders and carjackings are way up. Last year, the city council decreased the size of the police department. What has that done to us? What has it done? I mean, we need more officers, do we not?
Absolutely, we do. So let me go back a little bit further than last
okay.
year. So beginning in June of 2020, we started to hear a lot of rhetoric, and obviously everyone remembers the protests of that summer about police accountability and police brutality.
Right.
And what the city council's response to those calls were to pass what they called the Policing and Justice Reform Act of 2020. And this was an incredibly sweeping bill. It's about a 50-page bill that has 26 subtitles in it. And each one of these subtitles has pretty serious, significant impacts to policing in the city. When we came out, when that bill was introduced, we tried to warn the city council to say, listen, you're going too far here. We understand that there needs to be accountability, that officers need to make sure that when they engage in misconduct, that there's consequences for that misconduct. We agree with that. That's absolutely critical to have a legitimate, trustworthy and functional police department. However, these provisions that you're including in this bill are going to be detrimental to police officers being able to do their job in a constitutional, responsible, professional way. And ultimately what it's going to result in is a mass exodus of police officers, an exponential increase in violent crime. We were roundly dismissed, particularly by the city council, and there was quite a bit of rhetoric and activism around the issue, and our complaints and our concerns were drowned out. That bill ultimately passed in an emergency and temporary status here in the district, and so those provisions went into effect almost immediately. And since that time, we've lost 1,250 police officers. And more than half of those separations are people who've resigned from the department. And what we hear from them as they're processing out is that they don't want to work in an environment with these onerous provisions that expose them to all of these penalties, civil, administrative, even criminal penalties, even when they're doing their job appropriately. And that's the environment that we're in right now. The department has only been able to hire about 600 people in that same time, meaning that we're down about 600 cops. And let me give you the raw numbers. In the beginning of 2020, we had just under 3,900 police officers. And right now we have just under 3,300 police officers. So we're 600 officers short from where we were 3 years ago. And the recruiting is just abysmal. It's almost impossible to get people interested in this job, particularly here in this jurisdiction. The mayor has offered $20,000 signing bonuses. That didn't move the needle. She's now upped it to $25,000 signing bonuses, and that's still not moving the needle. And our position here as the rank and file officers is that we need to get the city council to repeal some of these very onerous provisions that make it so hard to be a police officer in the district. And if we can get that done, I think we can turn this ship around and get more police officers on the department. And really, even more importantly, stop the hemorrhaging of officers who are leaving this jurisdiction and going to other law enforcement agencies that don't have the same type of measures that have been implemented. And ultimately, that's what we believe is really fueling this crime crisis, is the lack of officers on the street. The response times have gone up exponentially. The number of officers that show up on these scenes of violent crime are minimal, meaning that, you know, leads and witnesses and evidence that might be there is not being collected in the same way it used to be. The number of detectives that show up that are investigating these cases and the number of detectives we have to investigate these cases is down. And ultimately, that's resulting in a real loss in terms of actually holding criminals accountable. And I can put that in empirical data. Over the past 10 years, between 2008 and 2018, we were averaging about 40 to 45,000 arrests per year. Over the past 3 years, we've only been averaging about 15,000. And that's really where, you know, the rubber meets the road of holding criminals accountable, is this front end of being able to go out and arrest people who develop probable cause and arrest people who are involved in violent crime, get them into the criminal justice system so that they can be held accountable. And really that part of the system is broken because we don't have enough police officers.
Well, you know, first of all, let me get a few things straight with you. I think that my opinion of that whole scenario is that their reaction was knee-jerk to political pressure that was being put on them, which is not unusual for the city council, unfortunately. But am I wrong that this rarely happens in the District of Columbia, that we really rarely have these serious complaints? I mean, we all remember George Floyd. But I don't remember an incident like that in the District of Columbia. I don't remember district cops being. I got to tell you, I grew up in a bad neighborhood, and my interaction with the D.C. police is that they're better than the cops I remember growing up with. I don't know if it's your training or the environment or whatever, but they tend to be very helpful. They tend to, we always in our neighborhood, in our bad neighborhood, we worried about the police. We were afraid of the police. I don't think people in Washington are afraid of the police. I think they see the police as helpful. And I think that this reaction by the city council was just incredible. It was just an incredible knee-jerk reaction to the pressure of a handful of loud voices. And I could tell you that in my neighborhood, I live in Ward 3, Detective Pemberton, and we have pretty low crime here, but people are really starting to get work. We've had a gun battle on one street that's close by in Chevy Chase, and we've had murders on Connecticut Avenue, and, you know, people are starting to get concerned about this. And I also want to add that I, about 2 weeks ago, had a friend that I couldn't contact, and I had the police do a well check, and they ended up having to break into her apartment where they found her dead on the floor. So after the detective arrived and did a crime scene, you know, she died at home alone, so I guess they had to inspect it as a potential crime scene. When he came out and we asked him for information, and he said, well, you can contact me or I'll contact you, but I have 50 cases. He said to us, I have 50 cases. I said, you have 50 active cases? And he went, yeah. And I said to my wife, We won't be able to get a hold of this guy. You know, he probably doesn't have enough hours in the day to take care of 50 separate cases. So it seems to me that the workload is horrendous. And You know, you've got to be putting up with pressure. Is this not true from Montgomery County and Fairfax County, where they have lower crime? I mean, why wouldn't I want to be a cop in Fairfax or be a cop in Montgomery County as opposed to D.C.? D.C. is a tougher assignment, is it not? And don't we have to? I mean, look, I'm pissed. I think you're being very kind in your description of the city council. Phil Mendelson came out this week and said the most incredible thing that a political leader could say. You can get away with murder in the District of Columbia. That's outrageous, in my opinion. And then he tried to defend it by saying that it was really, if the police closed more cases and if the mayor did her job, that it would be, you know, that things would resolve themselves. He said it's not the job of the city council to deal with crime. It's your job and it's the mayor's job. But it's the city council that passes legislation that affects all this stuff. First of all, I believe that crime is everybody's problem. I want to tell you that I'm proud of the fact that I used to be a neighborhood watch captain. And while I was on the neighborhood watch, I intervened in two violent crimes. And by intervening, I mean I got the police involved. And in both cases, those led to an arrest. We all need to take a part in this, don't we?
You're absolutely right. So let me take a couple of those things one piece at a time.
Okay,
First of all, Phil Mendelson coming out and saying that you can get away with murder in the District of Columbia might be one of the most irresponsible things I've heard a city council member say in my almost 20 years of doing this job. And that's a pretty high bar. And it does so many things that are so harmful. You know, one, it sends a message to criminals that they can get away with crime. This is the chief legislator in the district saying that you're not going to be arrested if you commit murder, which is just horrific. But it also continues to demonize the cops. As you mentioned, it suggests that somehow cops aren't able to do their job. They're not able to close cases and that we don't have the resources. And so, you know, he keeps repeating, well, the council we don't have badges. We can't arrest people, as if somehow city council members could have an impact. It just goes to show how incompetent and how, disconnected that Phil Mendelson and some others on the council are from the problems and the crises that we have. And I'm glad you pointed it out, because it really is a great example of how misguided they are. And going back to your earlier comment of how the knee-jerk reaction of the rhetoric that was out there regarding police accountability, they passed this, you know, wild bill that included so much language that was fed to them by some of the most anti-police activist groups in the country. And many of them are not from D.C. They just knew that D.C. was a ripe place to see if they could get these things passed. And they came in and they spent millions of dollars advocating for these things. And ultimately, this bill is now law. And we all have to live under it, which is one that prevents police officers from doing their jobs. But I want to go back to something that you asked a moment ago, which was, you know, hey, do police officers in D.C. have the same kind of problems with this misconduct that we see in other jurisdictions? And you're right that the answer is no. I mean, as an example, you know, a lot of people talk about these chokeholds and how chokeholds should be banned. Well, the D.C. Council banned chokeholds in 1986. Under the Prohibition on Neck Restraints Act. And ever since then, for almost 40 years, police officers in the District of Columbia have been prohibited from using neck restraints to choke people or to try to subdue them. And we understand that and we respect that. And we know that that's against policy. It's against the law. And we also understand the optics of how citizens can see that as a brutal tactic. And that's something that's important to us. But then, you know, the city council comes in and they modify it. They add language to it because they want to be the champions of this issue, even though it's already been resolved here in the district. And now the what the law says is that even inadvertent contact with a suspect's neck during a use of force constitutes a neck restraint. And we now see dozens of officers facing termination and facing serious discipline, you know, just for their forearm brushing up against someone's neck while they're tussling on the sidewalk with an armed robber. And that's the kind of thing that has an incredibly chilling effect on officers wanting to get out of the car, wanting to do these investigations, wanting to engage the community, because they know that even if they go out and do their job properly, there could be all of these consequences to their actions. And that's just one small example of the problems that exist in that bill that they passed, the Policing and Justice Reform Act. But the fact is that, you know, if we don't approach these issues honestly, you can't fix them. I'm of the mindset that if something's wrong, you have to approach it honestly. Otherwise, you're not going to come up with a viable solution. So, you know, unfortunately, there are certain circumstances where officers have engaged in misconduct. But what I always ask people when I have this discussion with them is, can you name me single incidents where a Metropolitan Police Department officer has engaged in misconduct and has not been held accountable? And everyone looks at me blankly, because the fact is that when in those very rare circumstances where an officer has done something wrong, they've either been terminated, they've been sent to the grand jury, they've been indicted, they may have been charged with a crime. Some of them have even been convicted of crimes and obviously fired and dismissed from the department. And I think that's what people are asking for, is that when an officer engages in that level of misconduct, that he or she is dealt with. And when that's usually the first question that I ask when I get engaged in these debates. I say, well, can you name situations where someone's engaged in this misconduct and has not been held accountable? And everyone draws a blank, because the answer is that our city does take that kind of conduct seriously. And our department takes it seriously, and our union takes it seriously. And so trying to lump accountability on top of accountability on top of accountability just creates an environment where good police officers, which is 99.9% of them, can go out and do their job. There's 9 different entities that investigate police officers in this city, and many of them are very biased and are filled with people who are notoriously anti-police. And when they get their hands on these investigations, they go after these cops hard, and ultimately those investigations and the results of those investigations hamper people's careers, which drives officers out of the department, because ultimately they were doing the right thing in the first place. And the bill that I keep continuing to harp on removes their due process rights. It eliminates their collective bargaining rights. It eliminates their right to be able to address some of these allegations, whether they come from citizens through the Office of Police Complaints or they come internally from the department. The bill eliminates all of their rights that they used to have to try to defend themselves against fraudulent allegations. And so people don't want to be in a situation where they can be accused of something, can't defend themselves, and then have the allegations sustained. That's why many people have decided to leave this agency. And these are the kind of things we need to fix, because creating an environment where people don't want to work here means that the department is going to have to lower their standards to keep the numbers up. And that, to me, is one of the most dangerous things about managing a police agency, is if you're making sacrifices about who you hire, those are potential future problems where people can be hurt, or that the department can be accused of not doing their job properly. And so, you know, if you want to fix the police department, or you want to improve a police department, or you want it to reduce the number of times where this misconduct exists, the way to do that is by improving the people that you bring into the agency, right? Being more scrutinizing about who you hire, being more scrutinizing about the pool of candidates that you select and that you move on through the hiring process, not driving people out and then struggling to find anyone, candidates that want to do the job. That ultimately is going to degrade the police agency. And that's one of the most frustrating things that we've found, is that the rhetoric that's out there that the city council is responding to is actually having the opposite effect of what they're suggesting. They're suggesting that these bills fix the police department, when really what they do is long-term is they degrade it and destroy it. And so it's a very frustrating place to operate from.
Well, you know, let's keep in mind a few things about Metropolitan Police. One thing that I think everybody has to remember is that on January 6th, it was the Metropolitan Police Department that saved the day. They came in and backed up the Capitol Police, who, by the way, I deal with all the time, and they're a very competent group of police officers at Capitol Police, but they were overwhelmed. And it was the Metropolitan Police that came in and and resolve the situation. I'm right about that, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, on January 6th, when the Capitol Police became overrun, we sent in about 850 police officers from all over the city. And I think without that show of force and without those officers that are skilled in dealing with civil disturbance and riots, God knows what could have happened inside the building that day. So I do think that the Metropolitan Police Department deserves some credit for bringing that situation under control. The Capitol Police did everything they could, but I think that they didn't have the resources or the manpower to defend themselves against what was coming. And so it really was an example of how police officers in the city are willing to put their lives on the line and get in front of any situation in any circumstance and bring it under control quickly. I think it was 4 hours between when the MPD police officer arrived on the scene and when the situation was rendered under control. I mean, that's pretty impressive given what was going on that day.
Well, and it also points to the fact that Metropolitan Police Officers, MPD in the District of Columbia, is expected to do some things that regular police officers, right, around the country. We have to escort diplomats. We have to protect. I mean, you've got the Secret Service and the Capitol Police, but there's also, you never see the president leave the White House that there's not a police car, a DC cop somewhere in the line of cars. You never see an event in DC, regardless of who is at that event, whether it's, you know, whether it's a national politician or a local guy. You never see an event where there aren't DC cops. DC cops have a lot of responsibility. And I got to tell you about the city council. The city council. Now, in my family, I'm considered so liberal that there are people that probably won't talk to me. But the city council is off the hook. They want to let 16-year-olds vote. They want to let people that aren't even American citizens vote. They want to, they have all sorts of really left-wing ideas that they want to impose on the people of the District of Columbia. And I'm not against being liberal, but there's got to be a point. And I also, like I told you, grew up in a bad neighborhood. And I understand some things about criminals. One is, if you think they're dumb, you're wrong. They're very, very smart. In fact, some of them have extremely high IQs. In addition to that, a lot of the people that you deal with every day are crazy. They're absolutely, you know, they have serious mental problems that need to be dealt with. So to tie the hands of the police, in my opinion, is just really, really ridiculous. And it's short-sighted, and it's pandering to the lowest denominator in politics. And, you know, we've seen recently that the city council sent their reform crime bill up to Congress, and what did Congress do with it? They rejected, for the first time in 35 years, they rejected a bill from the District of Columbia. And we worked very hard to get Democrats to support our effort to become a state, and we lost 44 Democrats on that bill. 44 Democrats sided with the Republicans. So the only thing the bill did was it accomplished bringing bipartisanship back to the District of Columbia, back to Congress, because both Republicans and Democrats really said it was a dumbass thing to issue, a dumb thing to do. And so, yeah, you got no argument with me in the city council, but let me ask you about the crime bill. Did you guys review the crime bill? What did you think of the crime bill? Do you think it was that Congress did the right thing, or did it need to be reformed in the ways it was being reformed? And we all know the mayor had a different opinion on the crime bill than the council did.
Yeah, so the revised Criminal Code Act, which is what you're discussing here, originally when it was introduced by the council, We went through it, and it was hundreds of pages of updates to the criminal code. And frankly, there was not that much in there that was offensive to us. I think there was a couple of things that we, it rankled us a little bit, or we rolled our eyes about, but there was nothing that we were, that caused us to run around city council stomping our feet and having, you know, a temper tantrum about what was in there. And we reviewed it very carefully, and we felt like, well, this a lot of what's in here does seem to be legitimate. It does seem to be updating the code. It's modernizing it. I think we're fine with it. The problem came in the 11th hour, which is typical with the city council and their sort of sneaky legislative procedures, is they went to a markup hearing on the bill, and they added mountains of this extra progressive ideology that you mentioned earlier, which eliminated all of the minimum sentences for every crime in the entire criminal code book, with the exception of first degree murder. It reduced all of the maximum sentences across the board by at least half. And it created an environment in which it would be nearly impossible for police officers to put people in jail, even if they were arrested, indicted, and convicted of heinous violent crimes. And it was basically once we looked at what it was after the markup came through, we understood that this was going to be absolutely detrimental to policing in the city, because no matter, even if we had 100% closure rate on all of our cases, 100% of those people would never see the inside of a jail based on the way that they had amended the bill through this markup procedure. So that's when we got involved, and we went back to the council. And that's when we did start stomping our feet, and we did start yelling and screaming and said, hey, look, our job is to go out here and protect these neighborhoods, particularly the most vulnerable neighborhoods in the city that are plagued with violence. And we're not going to be able to do that under these provisions. And we were met with millions of dollars of nonprofit activists from all over the country who had nothing to do with D.C., who came in and started pushing the city council around to make sure they passed that bill in that iteration. And they never changed anything, regardless of who came out from D.C., whether it was cops, whether it was the chief of police, whether it was the prosecutor or the OAG or citizens themselves who said, hey, you can't do this. They ignored everyone. And they listened to these, you know, millions of dollars in activist nonprofits to push this bill through. And they pushed it through without changing anything after that markup went through. And so at that point in time, knowing that there was nothing that the city council was going to do to fix this, we made our case to the mayor. The mayor had already made up her mind, and she did the right thing, which was to veto that bill because of those last minute provisions that took place in the markup. And what the council should have done was listen to the mayor, listen to the police, listen to the citizens, and gone back and fixed those changes that were in there. Because as the mayor stated herself, everyone was fine with this bill before the markup. Why don't we pass that version of it and then come back through individual amendments and make some of these changes? And that way citizens can weigh in, and there can be a more deliberative process on making these sort of specific amendments that are controversial. And that was the most common sense thing that anyone in the debates could have said. Yet the council dismissed her. They called her all kinds of names, and they overrode her veto. And at that point, the bill had to go to Congress. And you know, we respect the District of Columbia. We respect the idea that the citizens of the district should be able to vote. But at some point in time, people need to step in to make sure that, that more citizens don't die at the hands of the city council and their ridiculous policies. So we actually advocated for Congress to overturn that, which is a frustrating place to be, because, you know, we were lambasted by district residents who advocate for statehood and thought that we were getting in the way of those arguments. But our analysis on that was lives of the district citizens are more important than the argument for statehood right now. And that's what we're going to do, because that's our job, is to protect the safety and sanctity of these neighborhoods. And we know that this is going to be detrimental for that. So that's the one issue we're arguing. We're not arguing about statehood for or against. We're arguing to save people's lives. We went to Congress. Congress took it up. And as you stated, it was a bipartisan issue. Many Democrats saw this, and what we heard when we were on the Hill is they're really risking their arguments towards statehood by advancing these type of bills, because now we have to have these debates, and now we have to have weigh in on this. And if the council was smart, they wouldn't do this, because it is jeopardizing and harming those arguments. It's making a national spectacle out of the city. And fortunately for us, it not only passed the House, but passed the Senate. And when it got down to Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House, the president saw the same problems that we did. He signed it, which disapproved the bill. And the RCCA is now defunct. And citizens of the District of Columbia don't have to worry about those liberal criminal policies. I think what's frustrating is there was good work that was done to the RCCA on the front end. And unfortunately, because the city council wanted to listen to crazy radical activists and add some of these ridiculous provisions in the last minute, all of that good work that went into it on the front end is now scuttled with the entire bill.
Well, and what you say is true, and it's and yes, we don't want to lose the advocates that we have on Capitol Hill that support the idea that we should have a vote and that we should be equal, but we also don't want to lose the people that represent us here in Washington on a bill like that, and that was a real problem, you know. And I called the city council petulant children. I said they acted like, you know, well, we passed this. They should have known that Congress was going to overturn. But they passed it, and they said, well, we're just going to send it up there because this is what we want. And I said all it reminded me of was one of my teenage children, if I can think back that far, standing up and telling me what they're going to do, you know, saying to me, well, if you don't do this, I'm going to do, you know, making idle threats and being ridiculous. And that's what I said about them. They sound like teenagers, you know, this is what we want. So this is what we're going to do. And I think you're right. I think we lost support internally and externally. And the thing that really bothers me, and I don't know if you can address this or not, but it bothers me that the only victims now are people that commit crimes. When I hear the narrative, they talk about kids whose lives have been ruined by being sent to jail or having some or being detained without a trial or whatever the situation is. But they don't talk about the 14-year-old boy that was shot and killed. They don't talk about the 13-year-old that was killed. They don't talk about the fact that we have children out shooting NFL football players on the street. You know, none of those people are victims. The only victims are the criminals. And unfortunately, you know, I agree with you. We have to support the police, and it has to come from the top. You say that you think that the statement that Phil made was irresponsible, and I agree with you, and so does the mayor. But I think when he followed up with, it's not the council's problem. It's not the crime is not the council's problem. All of a sudden, I mean, it was their problem when they reformed the crime bill, and they just passed another reform bill the other day, emergency legislation. You know, Brooke Pinto put forth a bill that is more like the mayor's bill, but it's just outrageous to me that, and is this a result of lobbying groups that we, you know, that we hear so much about the criminals who have been victimized, but not as much about the victims? I mean, what lives are destroyed by this every day, and you guys see that every day, you know? So I don't get it. I want to support the police, and I think most Washingtonians want to support the police. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. You've correctly stated that these activists have come in, these justice groups, whatever you want to call them. There's about a dozen of them or so that are really well-funded. Almost none of them have any stake in the District of Columbia. They're all outside sort of national groups. Many of them are from California or New York, and they have all of this abundance of money through donations and fundraising that they use to influence the council. And basically, they've made the District of Columbia like lab rats for these policies, which is very frustrating because the citizens are saying the exact opposite. When you hear them and you listen, particularly in the testimony of people who come into the council who provide written and oral testimony, when you go to the ANC meetings, when you go to these community meetings, when you look at them on the news, everyone is saying the same thing, is that we want more police and we want more accountability for criminals and we want to bring the crime rate down. The activists are saying the opposite, which is, as you very astutely pointed out, they've turned the criminal into the victim and then they've stopped talking about the actual victims, the people who are shot, the people who are robbed, who are armed carjacked, who are raped, or the family members of those who are murdered. Those people have completely evaporated from the conversation. And now the only person that's ever referred to as a victim is the criminal who committed the crime himself. And that, and by turning that conversation upside down, it has allowed the city council to focus all their legislative efforts on protecting criminals. And in the meantime, they have completely disregarded the victim in the city, which it doesn't matter how minor the crime is. I mean, you know, you have a bicycle stolen or you have your laptop stolen from a coffee shop. That's something, it may not be violent. It may not have physically harmed you, but that's something that you're always going to remember. You feel vulnerable. You feel violated. And obviously those feelings get worse as the crimes get more serious. Someone breaks into your home, someone physically assaults you, or, you know, God forbid you lose a loved one to a murder. These are things that people have to live with, the trauma that they have to live with for the rest of their lives. And we don't do anything to discuss them or consider them in any of this legislation. The only thing that anybody wants to consider is how does it impact the criminal? And we've kowtowed and we've advocated to these activist groups for over 3 years now. And the empirical data is in. It has been an abject failure. And until the city council looks at the work product that they've put out and says, hey, this didn't work, and start undoing a lot of the things that they've done, I unfortunately don't see this thing turning around anytime soon. I'm very optimistic about seeing the council earlier this week take on some, although, albeit in my description, minor increases and improvements to the criminal justice system. It was very, I think, encouraging to see the vast majority and sometimes unanimously the council vote for these provisions. But these things are a drop in the bucket for what needs to be done, because the sweeping changes that they made in 2020 and 2021 and again in 2022, we haven't done anything to scale them back. And until we do that on a more broad level, we're not going to fix the police department. We're not going to fix the ability for officers to go out and identify perpetrators and arrest them. We're certainly not going to fix the criminal justice system in terms of charging, prosecuting, convicting, and sentencing these people. So there's a long way to go. And I hope people don't think that because they passed a bill that seems like it's pro public safety or pro law enforcement, that we're done. I mean, this is, we're just turning the first page of the book here, and we have hundreds of pages to go. But I think it's a very salient point, and it's something that we've raised throughout and been ignored, which is, why aren't we hearing from the victims in these cases? Why do we not consider what these criminals are doing to these neighborhoods, to these communities, or to the individual, and why we shouldn't be doing more to protect people from having to go through that? And I think it's another one of the most more frustrating aspects of this kind of advocacy.
Well, you know, I remember the only bad neighborhood I ever lived in Washington was I lived on Thomas Circle before the riots right after the riots in 1968. It was the center in Washington, D.C. for prostitution. There are many people, many activists out there calling prostitution a victimless crime and, you know, trying to put in safety measures to help the prostitution. Nobody did anything to move they used to move the prostitutes around. You know, they would come in, they would clean them up, but they'd be back. We had really high crime in that neighborhood until the prostitutes were gone because, you know, I don't think people realize that crime begets crime. I mean, it's not just like there's illegal prostitution going on in your neighborhood. There's all sorts of other things going on in your neighborhood that are directly related to that. We certainly saw in New York City, for example, when they started to crack down on misdemeanors, they didn't for a while, and they started, I think, under Ed Koch to crack down on misdemeanors, that crime dropped precipitously because the same guys that are shoplifting or doing something, you know, under the table. That's not all they're doing. They're not just going to a prostitute and going home, or shoplifting and going home. They're doing all sorts of things. And criminals, I've known a few in my life, they're very smart, and they're very sensitive to the environment in which they work. They're more sensitive to that than any other aspect. So they know when there's less cops on the street. They know when people are not getting arrested and prosecuted. I understand, and I don't know if this is true, but I understand that now, you know, they used to jump you into a gang. Now, if you want to prove your street cred, so you go out and carjack. And that's crazy that you can do that. Where did this crime come from? Years ago, we didn't have carjackings. I mean, it was very, very rare. Now it's like you can't pick up a newspaper without reading about it. And we've had horrible situations where we had those two girls that ended up killing the cab driver after they stole his car. And the football player that plays for the Commanders that was shot twice by a little teenage boy. You know, here's a guy that's 6'2 and 240 pounds, and these guys weren't intimidated by him. So my next question is, what can we do about guns? Is there anything we knew about guns? You know, I've had a couple of 14-year-old children in my life. I had three of them. And you don't want them to have a gun, you know, especially a 14-year-old boy. You don't want him to have a gun. So is there anything we can do to crack down on that we're not doing, and that's been affected by legislation that the council has passed?
Absolutely. So this is one of the more sensitive issues that I like to talk about, is that when you hear politicians in the District of Columbia talk about crime, they like to talk about crime, particularly violent crime, and they couch it in the term illegal guns. And they say, well, the reason we have these problems is because there's too many illegal guns, there's too many people with illegal guns, there's too much access to illegal guns, and we need to go after the guns. We've heard every elected politician in the city say that, particularly over the past 3 or 4 years. That is their go-to talking point. And, you know, while I don't necessarily agree, I think it's a fine idea, right? Let's go after illegal guns. Let's make sure we do that. The problem is that it's an empty statement. The reason being is because our officers and our detectives, we go out every year. We lock up about 2,000 people who are in possession of an illegal gun. You know, these are guns that have the serial number scratched off, with these extended magazines that are, you know, known to be stolen. These aren't people with a concealed carry permit or something like that. These are people who are carrying an illegal weapon in the District of Columbia, and we arrest them when they're in possession of it. And you know what the going rate is for people who are convicted of that? Is 6 months probation. Mm. That's what people get. That's the going rate right now for being in possession of an illegal gun in the District of Columbia. If we want to change that culture, we need to change that penalty. Because if all you have to do is just be on supervised probation for 6 months and it's no big deal, then no one's going to be prohibited from carrying or wearing or possessing or using a gun because there's no consequence for it. And so if we start taking that seriously, because the maximum penalty for carrying a pistol without a license, that's the charge that we use, we call it CPWL, is 5 years in prison. And if we actually start holding people accountable for carrying these guns around, that message will get out in the community. And people will stop carrying those guns because people aren't going to want to spend time behind bars for that. And you will reduce the number of people that are carrying and using guns. And that's the idea about reducing violence. But when you have that discussion with people, they try to tell you all of these old tropes that aren't true. Like, oh, you can't incarcerate your way out of this, or increased penalties don't reduce crime. These are all preposterous ideas that are empirically false. And there's data everywhere that shows that that's not true. The United States Sentencing Commission, both in 2018 and in 2022, came out with their reports showing that there is a clear connection between the length of a sentence and the potential for recidivism. And it showed that the longer the sentence was, the less likely the person was to recidivate, which is just common sense, right? The lower the sentence is, the more likely someone is to commit a crime again. That's just this obvious to your casual observer. And the science shows that. The data that's out there shows that. Now, you can go find a bunch of data from these activist groups that say the opposite. But if you, the United States Sentencing Commission, both under a Republican president and under a Democrat president, have published lengthy reports that show the opposite is true. And to me, that's the authority on this. They're the ones that are looking at how long these sentences are and whether or not they're effective. And the reports that they publish show that lengthier sentences are effective. So if we want to reduce the number of guns that are in this community, one, we need to start punishing people that are carrying them around. But that's also going to beget another aspect of law enforcement, which is that people who are arrested for carrying guns and are facing a significant sentence will be a lot more likely to tell the police and law enforcement and prosecutors where they got the guns. And then we can use our investigative resources and our undercover officers and our federal partners out there in the ATF or the FBI to actually go after people that are bringing guns into the district and distributing them or selling them to people. And if we could figure out what that pipeline is and start arresting those people, then we might actually be able to reduce the number of guns that are here in the city. But again, this all involves serious, legitimate law enforcement. And that's what the city council doesn't want, is us going out and doing our job. So until they start to reverse that position on not allowing us to go out and do professional, responsible, effective policing, you're not going to see a change in these numbers. You're just going to see them continue to spew this rhetoric. Oh, we got to do something about the illegal guns and incarcerating people is not the solution. That's going to be the same talking point that you will hear for years. And you will continue to see the numbers of violent crime go up and up and up because we're not doing anything legitimate about it.
Well, you know, another aspect of this, too, that I don't think people realize, and given my ill-spent youth, I have a little experience with this, but guns give young people a false sense of empowerment. So as the neighborhood gets worse and as crime increases, you'll see more kids with wanting to get guns, wanting to feel like they need to protect themselves from other, you know, other gang members or other drug dealers or whoever else in the neighborhood is doing business. And I mean, again, crime begets crime. And as the neighborhood degrades, I think you're going to find more, because I knew kids that carried guns when I was a teenager. I was an orphan and I was on my own, and I knew kids that carried them, and that was it. They felt like it made them safe. Of course, it doesn't make them safe. All it does is get them in trouble. But you know, so it it's all really tied together in a kind of a web, just like any environment. So as the environment gets worse, so do the crimes, I think. And again, I agree with you. I think we need more cops on the street to keep that from happening. And again, I was astounded by this police officer that responded to help us, that told us he had 50 active cases. I'm like, how can this guy do that? You know, that's such a workload. And that's another thing. You not only are we got less cops out there, but the cops you got out there are, you know, being worn down. Are they not? Isn't this job getting harder and harder with less cops?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And what you're describing is one of the problems that we have that's sort of self-perpetuating. So as the number of police officers goes down, the workload on each police officer that's here, or detective, as you've mentioned, which is another salient point, those caseloads and those workloads go up. And not only that, but crime has gone up considerably. From, let's say, 5 years ago when we had 3,900 police officers, crime was considerably lower than it is now. And so now that crime is up and the number of police officers are down, the demand and the workload on each individual police officer is exorbitant. And that 50 caseload is not unusual. You know, I've been a detective for 15 years of the 18 years I've been on this department. And, you know, what I hear from my coworkers is that they're at 40, 45, 50 cases a month, whether they're working carjackings or robberies or burglaries or, you know, even just misdemeanor crimes. That their caseloads are in the 40s and 50s, which that's more than one case a day. And that's a considerable amount of work that you're asking those detectives to do. And ultimately what happens is they're not able to invest the amount of time that's necessary to get the leads and close the cases, meaning that as Chairman Mendelson pointed out, well, your closure rate is down. Well, that's because we don't have enough people out here, and we've been clamoring for years to get more people on the department. And the only thing that the council has been doing is demonizing us, so nobody wants to work here. And now the council member has the audacity, the temerity to come out and say, well, how come you can't close these cases? And if you need more resources, why don't you let us know what they are? Well, we told you in public testimony, in written testimony, in press releases in June of 2020, when you said, hey, we're going to do all this stuff to the police department, we said, please don't. This is going to result in a catastrophe. And you ignored us. And ever since then, we've been asking you to repeal some of these measures. We've been asking you to help us get more police officers on the street. You've ignored us. And now the chairman has the gall to say, well, I don't know what kind of resources they need. And if they need resources, they should let us know so we can get it to them. Yeah. It's a preposterous dodge. Yeah. And he knows that he's responsible for all of these murders, him and Charles Allen in particular, that they're directly responsible for the number of people that have been killed in this year, the city over the past few years. And they're trying to avoid responsibility as per typical of the city council. And it's embarrassing. It's tragic. It's frustrating. And frankly, I hope that they come to their senses and realize that they need to do something significant in order to help us bring this thing under control.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, I've known Phil Mendelson for a long time. I thought he was a decent councilman, but he's not a leader. He shouldn't be leading the city council because he's not a leader. A leader doesn't stand up and ridicule the people that work for him because the job's not getting done. He looks and sees what he can do to make it easier. You know, I was a salesman for a long time, officer, and the only sales manager I had that was worth a damn was a guy that thought his job, most sales managers think their job is to make you sell more somehow, criticize you, or he thought his job was to do everything possible to make your job easier so you would be more effective. And I think that's what the city council should do too, is do everything they can to support the police, to make the police more effective, not stand up there and criticize them. So here's the last question for you, because we're running out of time, and this may be the most important one. What can we do as citizens? What do I need to do? What does every Washingtonian, anybody that's listening to the show, what do we need to do to get the council on the right track and support the police and you know, make the city safe?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is that if you're a resident of the District of Columbia, you need to get on the phone or send an email to your council member or the council members at large, and particularly the chairman, Phil Mendelson, and you need to let him know that the Policing and Justice Reform Act of 2022 needs to be repealed. And the reason it needs to be repealed is because police officers can't do their job under the 26 subtitles and 50 pages of hamstringing of the cops that exists in that bill. And if you tell them that they need to start listening to the police officers, the rank and file police officers, about what they need to be able to go out and properly police these communities and reduce the amount of violence that's out there, then we can probably get some work done. Unfortunately, what we hear when we go to the council members and try to have logical, common sense, diplomatic, professional conversations with them is that we're the problem and that we're not allowed to be in the conversation and that we're not allowed to have any input on the decision making of public safety and law enforcement in the city. And we now know, after 3 years of them ignoring us, exactly where that's gotten us. Exponential increases in every single crime category. And so you'd think that they would backpedal and say, well, hey, rank and file police officers, maybe you were right. What can we do to help you? They still have yet to do that. So if you're a citizen of the District of Columbia, I encourage you to do that. Or you can go to enoughisenoughdc.com. We have a website there that helps you that will guide you to your council member so that you can actually make some of these complaints through there, and we'll make sure that those complaints get to the proper authorities.
Well, we'll post that website if people want to go to our website and get, if you know, we'll put the website up there so you know how to access it. And that's a great note to stop on. Let me tell you, Officer, I think you are an amazing spokesperson for your constituents, for the police department. And I thank you very much for your service to the District of Columbia. I can tell you that I knew a lot of cops growing up, a lot of people that became cops. There's good cops, there's bad cops, but we all need to support the police department because they've got an incredibly difficult job, and the city council didn't make it any easier. So I hope you'll come back. There's 1,000 other questions for you at some point, and I very much appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us today.
Senator Brown, it was a pleasure. I'm happy to come back anytime, and you let me know if you have any questions or if any of your listeners want to contact us. Please let us know, and we're happy to make ourselves available.
Okay. Detective Pemberton, keep up the good work, and let us know. You know, I hope you have my phone number, because if there's anything I can do, including testifying before the council, you let me know, and I'll be happy to do it on your behalf. And we're going to leave you today with a song. We always leave a song that we dedicate to our guests. And there were so many that we could have chosen from, but I chose an old Woody Guthrie song because I'm a former Teamster, and I believe in people that belong to unions. Unions are a good thing. And so here's Union Made by Woody Guthrie, and this goes out to all the D.C. cops. Everybody that's a member of the FOP. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator.